This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey y'all, Daniel here to let you all know that the Cannonball is brought to you by OnlineGreatBooks.com this month. OnlineGreatBooks.com is a web-based self-education curriculum where you will read the great books of the Western tradition. And it's absolutely terrific because not only will you be engaging with these great and powerful and important texts from throughout history, but also it is designed to teach you how to become a better reader by habit, a better reader and a better thinker. You will also be in, as part of this program, you will be involved in class discussions with other people who are reading the same books as you, all led in a Socratic method by a learned interlocutor, one of whom I've had the pleasure of engaging in just such a conversation with. It was absolutely terrific. So enrollment is open now. Just go to Online Great Books. You're going to want to enter a promo code. And our promo code here is C-A-N. That's promo code C-A-N. So go to OnlineGreatBooks.com, use promo code C-A-N to get 25% off your first 3 months and to let them know that the Cannonball sent you and to help support our show. So without any further ado, let's get on with Don Quixote. We finally got to Don Quixote. I'm excited. Are you excited? Let's hit it.
Hello, and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. This is Claude Myron Guzer, and with me is Daniel Doherty. Daniel, how you doing, man?
Hey, pretty good, considering. Any hardcore canon heads out there will realize this episode is coming out we're a little delayed. We're just a little bit. And I've been... my house has been... suffering through some kind of curse or some kind of ancient prophecy is being fulfilled. I don't know, but it's been basically Plague Summer 2K18 out here. And we're on like week three of at least one person in my family being sick, which I think we're finally out. I think we're finally rounding out of it all. But I was I caught the tail end of it myself. So if I sound a little hoarse, if I have to turn away and cough distantly, then that's what that's about. But yeah, man, I'm Claude. I just want to say, I appreciate so much that you're as well-versed in this work as I am, because I didn't really get to spend as much thoughtful time with the text as I usually do. And as I prefer to. So I'm going to be going off of a lot of my recollections of the last time that we read it. And honestly, your extremely, valuable synopsis.
So what you're saying is we're screwed. Okay.
No. Excuse me.
I see that the enchanter that is trying to subvert all of my activities has cursed you with a delirious cough that will pop up intermittently.
Intermittently, so. but you know what? His attempt to derail our noble pursuit is for naught. For we are both noble paladins, and we shall never be thwarted in our quest. And I'm really looking forward to it. I just wanted to apologize to the listeners. Like, I really, like, you know, it's been this big roll up to Don Quixote. Like, we had, like, you know, two special episodes of, like, introductory, and we're talking about it. We're all so excited. And then, of course, we drop off the radar for a few weeks. And then we come back, and I'm just coughing my lungs up and haven't done all the reading that I should have done. Well, but
what could be more quixotic than setting out with all the best intentions and failing miserably?
I love it. Let's hop on in there, man. Terrific. Okay,
I love this book. I really, really love this book. Even the second book, I've been talking to a friend of mine who's like, you know, I love the first book because it's so light and fun. It's the second book that gets really dark and kind of bums me out. But I love them both. I really love Don Quixote. And I've been trying to think about what it is that draws me into it so much. It's just fun. Mm-hmm. Like I was talking about this with Chris Ludovici, that it doesn't feel like an 800-page book or a 1,000-page book. It just breezes along.
It really does. Yeah, you're right.
And I was talking to another friend of mine who's read it, you know, many moons ago, but we were, I don't know, on our fourth or fifth beers, and he was saying, you know, the thing I remember about Don Quixote is it just jumps right in. There's little to no preamble. I mean, there's the introductory material and the kind of dialogic jokes that Cervantes is making with the introduction, the kind of meta narrative that he's establishing. Yeah. But in terms of the story itself, it just jumps right in.
It really does, like, quite literally, like, the within the first page, you know, the soon to be Don Quixote has decided, like, I shall be a knight errant.
Yeah,
it just goes off at a clip.
I think with a lot of these works, there's this expectation that there's a kind of ramble into it, and it, in the third page, Don Quixote's out of the house. You know, it's literally that fast. So yeah. I figured what we could do is begin with kind of the Cliff's Notes summary to walk anyone who's unfamiliar with the book through the book, and then dive into some of the other kinds of, I guess, analytical things that I'm really kind of ripping to talk about.
Yeah, right.
So, if anybody's curious, we are using the Grossman translation.
I think 2003 was the publishing date for that one. Yeah,
I believe so. But it really is a solid translation.
It's beautiful. It's incredibly fluid, and there are moments, of course, like. I think especially with a book like Don Quixote, translation matters a lot because Cervantes himself was playing with the language so much himself. Like, you got to be a good translator to know how to translate a Castilian writing how a Basque mispronounces Castilian.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Okay, so here is the Cliff's Notes summary, in case you've never read it, and Don Quixote is famously one of those books that is talked about and never actually read. So here we go. It starts off with a bang. Don Quixote adopts his identity and hits the road, and as soon as he's out there, he has this kind of self-overhearing or self-awareness. Mm-hmm. It's part of the meta-theatrical joke, meta-narratorial joke, that he is expecting someone to write him down. Write down his adventures. First, he's framing his own identity in terms of Amadis of Gaul, another one of these knights errant that he's read too much about. And he's thinking about the day when someone will actually write down his adventures. I mean, it's in chapter two. He has this, I hope I don't get sued for this, but I have to read this. He's walking, he's on his horse, Rocinante, who's this, you know, shriveled old nag, and he's riding out, just kind of strolling along, and he has this sort of monologue or I guess it's a soliloquy, because he's talking to himself. He says, "Who can doubt that in times to come, when the true history of famous deeds comes to light, the wise man who compiles them, when he begins to account my first sally so early in the day, will write in this manner: no sooner had rubicund Apollo spread over the face of the wide and spacious earth the golden strands of his beauteous hair, no sooner had diminutive and bright-hued birds with dulcet tongues greeted in sweet mellifluous harmony the advent of rosy dawn, who, forsaking the soft couch of her zealous consort, revealed herself to mortals through the doors and balconies of the Manchegan horizon, then the famous knight, Don Quixote of La Mancha, abandoning the downy bed of idleness, mounted his famous steed Rocinante, and commenced to ride through the ancient and illustrious countryside of Montiel." He's immediately thinking of himself as a literary character. Yes, so he's kind of written himself into his own story, and he's imagining that someone will narrate him. So it's part of that meta-narrative structure that it just bleeds together. It's very difficult to disentangle. But that's Don Quixote's weird self-consciousness. So I think that's sort of like the oddity of him from the very beginning. Oddity in a good way. It's sort of what differentiates him from a lot of these other prose characters that you find in the time. All right, so he goes to the first inn. There's a running joke that he keeps mistaking inns for castles. It's a running joke, but it really only happens twice. Every inn he comes to, he thinks is a castle, but he only comes to two inns. So the first inn he goes into, he mistakes it for a castle. He sees a bunch of prostitutes around the door, thinks that they're fantastic ladies. He realizes that he hasn't been knighted yet and starts complaining about this to the innkeeper. The innkeeper is a kind of a Picaro. That's evidenced by the fact that he says he's written his own history at some point. Picaros were, I guess we talked about this last time, but one of the signifying factors of Picaros was that they were known for writing their histories, or that most picaresques claimed to be the real history of some rogue, more or less.
Right.
So the innkeeper is already involved in this kind of self-writing situation. He's also written himself as he envisions himself. Okay, but anyway, the innkeeper recognizes the sort of chivalric background that Don Quixote is drawing from and plays along with him. In the night, Don Quixote keeps watch over his armor, which he's set by the trough where the mules can get their water. A mule driver comes up, sees the armor, it's in the way, moves it. Don Quixote brains him with his lance. This gets him into some trouble because the innkeeper realizes he's causing a ruckus and this could bring down the cops and this could be like a whole situation. So he decides to get Don Quixote out of there as fast as possible. The innkeeper knights Don Quixote, sends him on his way, and Don Quixote feels good about having, you know, been finally knighted by the aristocrat, or the aristocratic lord that he feels is most appropriate.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the next chapter, Don Quixote, quote unquote, rescues a kid who hasn't been paid. The kid is being flogged by his master, and Don Quixote attempts to set him free. The master says, okay, sure, whatever, knight errant, I will set him free, and then, you know, I'll pay him everything that I owe him and more. Don Quixote leaves, and the master takes the boy back to be flogged even more.
Yeah.
Now, this is a famous case of, if anybody out there has read Nabokov's critique of Don Quixote, Nabokov did this kind of pedantic, I guess, chart of Don Quixote's wins, losses, and draws. This one he counts a loss, but Echevarria, the scholar that we were sort of drawing from last time, points out that later in the book, Don Quixote comes across this kid again, and the kid says that he's going to Seville, or to Sevilla. And the significant factor of that is Sevilla was known as the sort of – it was a port city, and it was known as the haunt of all the Picaros. So maybe the kid really deserved his flogging is the suggestion.
Right. And that's kind of hinted at in the – or I guess hinted at. I think that's kind of – that comes up in the text. in that, you know, we, the reader, know that Don Quixote is always wrongheaded, right? Yeah. So here he is trying to help who he assumes to be an innocent being, unjustly punished by some ogre or what have you. Well, you know, if Don Quixote is always, you know, off his noodle, then, you know, just like the innkeeper was not a Castellan, just like the local, ladies of the evening were not, in fact, ladies in waiting, I think you're onto something. Like, this is maybe not an innocent victim. He probably got into some stuff that, while I do not support capital punishment or corporal punishment, he may have had it coming in a sense.
Yeah. So okay, the next thing is Don Quixote tries to get a bunch of merchants and mule drivers to declare the beauty of Dulcinea, even though they haven't seen her. And the joke is, well, how can we declare her beauty if we haven't seen her? And Don Quixote says, her beauty is so magnificent, you don't have to see her.
And I guess
we should just take it on faith.
Yeah, and I guess we should mention, I don't know if you mentioned before, but Dulcinea is the not quite imaginary, I guess, noble lady that Don Quixote has dedicated his knight errancy to.
Thank you. That's something I sort of bypassed. In the very beginning, Don Quixote, in order to be the knight errant that he wants to be, he knows he has to have a lady love who he's not good enough for, who continually rejects him. So he's looking about for one and picks out this peasant woman who's sort of tilling the field, or I guess throwing hay, and says, she will be my ideal, and dubs her Dulcinea del Toboso. And everything he does for Dulcinea. We'll get into the weirdness of that. I have a sort of theory about that I want to run past you later on.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's developed this ideal woman that he does everything for. And so he asks these mule drivers and merchants to proclaim, like to swear, essentially, that they acknowledge the beauty of Dulcinea. They have to swear it without having seen her. So they have to make this religious oath. They decide they can't do that, and he pesters them to the point that they beat him up. And that's when he's found by a local farmer, like a farmer who's from his own village. And so the farmer picks him up, waits till nightfall so he won't be too embarrassed, and takes him back to his niece and housekeeper so that they can look after him. And he takes to bed to recover. And that's when the local priest and the local barber have this kind of mock auto de fe of all of Don Quixote's books. They go one by one through all his books of chivalry and basically make this arbitrary distinction. Okay, which one do we keep? Which one do we throw on? Sometimes there are some that the priest kind of sort of likes and he keeps them. Sometimes there are some that he's like, okay, this is trash. Let's toss it on. All right. They wall up the library itself so Don Quixote can't find it, and they work with his housekeeper and his niece to say, okay, it was an enchanter. An enchanter came in, walled up your library, burned all your books, so you don't get them anymore, and you just have to live with that. Yeah. And the thing about Don Quixote's madness, or supposed madness, is, well, that makes total sense to him. Of course an enchanter is out to get him, and of course an enchanter will steal all his books. So, you know, it's just in the way of things. He more or less accepts that. But a second sally out begins when he starts talking to his neighbor Sancho Panza, a fat peasant who works for him and sort of lives a couple houses over. He convinces Sancho Panza that he really is a knight errant, and if Panza goes along with him, then all kinds of riches will be at his disposal. In particular, he promises Sancho an insula, which is this old-fashioned term for an island for him to govern, and Sancho doesn't even really know what the term means, but he just knows that he'll be a governor, so he's going along with it. Yeah. Okay. It's when Don Quixote and Sancho set out together for the first time that we get the most famous episode in the whole novel, the episode of the windmills. It comes really early. It's over really quick. And if you're going into Don Quixote thinking he's going to be, quote unquote, tilting at windmills throughout the whole thing, you'll be sorely disappointed.
Yeah, and that's something that when I first read it, you know, when our first iteration of this project, you know, a couple of years ago, that was really surprising to me because and it makes me wonder. I would now be interested in the kind of the history of that scene becoming a synecdoche for the entire work. I would wonder, like, has that always been the most famous scene, or was that sort of selected sometime later, or what? It's interesting to me that that's always like that's the one Don Quixote thing everyone knows. And you're right, like it's over in a page. I mean, it's barely anything.
Yeah. So he thinks a bunch of windmills or giants, charges at him, gets knocked off his horse, gets back on, and just tells Sancho, "Well, you know what? It's that enchanter who's after me."
That enchanter just transformed them into windmills right at the last second.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of what's great about Don Quixote is that anything that goes wrong, well, it was an enchanter, you know.
So here we have Miguel de Cervantes prefiguring one of my favorite jokes from The Simpsons by about four centuries, when there was an episode where Lucy Lawless, television's Xena, was on the program as attending some kind of like NerdCon panel or whatever, and the comic book guy, you know, asked her about like some, you know, unlikely thing happening in the show, thinking it's like a continuity error, or pointing out a continuity error. And so she says, "Oh yeah, well, whenever you see anything like that, a wizard did it."
Yeah. Well, speaking of continuity errors, immediately after the fight with the windmill, he meets another caravan, and he believes that this woman who's traveling with them is a princess who needs to be rescued. She's traveling with this, Basque serving man who or servant of some capacity or protector or something, and he thinks Don Quixote is messing around and doesn't like him. Don Quixote gets into this altercation with the Basque. They get into a fight, and right in the middle of the fight with the Basque, the narrative breaks off.
Yeah, it's as Don Quixote is raising his sword above his head for a cleaving blow. And it's the end of the chapter. The narrative breaks off. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the next chapter says, well, that's the end of the story. So we were talking about this last time, but the whole meta-narrative joke is that, well, that's all we have of Don Quixote. But this narrator, this is where it gets really, really convoluted, and trying to pick out the strands is really messy. And it gets even messier in the second book. But the narrator claims that he is not the author. The author is someone else. The author of the book is some unknown writer, and he accidentally found the book written in Arabic in a stall in the city. So he finds the book, grabs it because he recognizes the name Don Quixote, and has somebody else translate it. So you've got the author, the translator, and the narrator. And the narrator claims to be someone other than the author and the translator. So you have these three strands of narrative that are kind of working against each other.
Yeah.
So even the narrator is this weird self-conscious entity who both is and is not written. So if he's not... Okay, who translated and who did what, and where does the narrator stand in terms of the translation? That's sort of what I'm asking here. This makes no sense. So you have a narrator claiming not to be the translated text that it purports to be.
Yeah.
So it's one more just bizarre joke that Cervantes is playing here.
And of course with the narrative itself being the narrative of a man who keeps reciting his own narrative of himself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it gets more convoluted as we go on. Okay, so Don Quixote accidentally beats the Basque because his horse missteps. But he's beaten up by everybody else. He claims to have a recipe for a balm that will cure him. They meet some goat herds who show him hospitality. They basically bring him in and say, hey, we don't have much, but kick back, relax, have some nuts and cheese with us. And that's where we get the story of Grisostomo and Marcella. Mm-hmm. Marcella was this beautiful girl from the town who wanted to live this Arcadian fantasy. So she dressed herself up like a shepherdess and just kind of went out to the woods. All the boys in town thought she was the most beautiful woman ever. So they dressed themselves up like shepherds and went out to sort of pursue her in this kind of Arcadian style. And this one particular shepherd who was madly in love with her, named Grisostomo, died. Now, you had the best take on this that I thought, or at least the funniest take on this that I thought I'd ever heard. What was your take on Grisostomo?
Oh, Lord, you put me on the spot. I can't remember what made such an impression on you now.
He was friend-zoned to death.
He was... See, this is, man, thank you for remembering all the times I'm super clever. But yeah, this is absolutely like from the way the story is told, it's this woman. And what's excellent about the story is that this woman never led him on. It wasn't like she ever said like, oh, I'll marry you if you do X, Y, or Z. It was just, she was flat out, no, I'm not interested. And that's enough to actually strike the man dead. According to the way the goat herds tell it.
Yeah, the way the goat herds tell it. But euphemistically, it's suggested that he killed himself.
Yeah.
And the goat herds are interested in this because there's going to be a big funeral the next day. Because Grisostomo, he left in his will how he wanted to be buried. And it wasn't on Christian ground. It was out in the woods. It was according to certain kinds of weird pagan rites.
Right.
And there's much of that that suggests that this couldn't be a Catholic burial. He killed himself.
Yeah.
He wants to be buried with a bunch of his poems. They find a bunch of his poems. When they wake up the next day, they go to his funeral. They find a bunch of his poems and read them. They're all about how horrible Marcella was to him. And then Marcella appears, and she appears out of nowhere and says, basically, leave me alone. Yes. It's not my fault if I'm beautiful. And this is one of the wonderful things about Don Quixote. Cervantes was living in an extraordinarily misogynistic time.
Oh yeah.
But the women in his novels, they're allowed to speak, and they often speak in ways that disrupt a lot of the kind of misogynistic expectation, I think. I don't want to claim that Cervantes was a feminist. I mean, there was no feminism at the time, but perhaps some parts of the text could be called proto-feminist or could be seen in that way.
Yeah, at least for nothing else than like having a woman character. And again, we should say this is a man writing in a woman's voice, but even so, like, you know, providing a voice for a woman character to speak for herself against the sort of calumnies being lobbed at her by these other people. And she's seriously saying like, look, seriously, all I ever wanted was to be left alone.
Right.
That's really, I wasn't even trying to exploit anybody. I wasn't trying to, you know, lead anybody on. I literally just want everyone to leave me alone.
Okay. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but her speech has dignity. Mm-hmm. She is allowed dignity, and she's allowed dignity in this way that I think really sort of disrupts some of the sort of love narratives that come up later. Anyway, a bunch of the shepherds or other, you know, boys from town who are pretending to be shepherds start to protest, and Don Quixote jumps up and says, I will defend her honor. And mostly because they realize it's going to be a hassle and they feel sort of ashamed, they disperse and leave Marcella alone. Okay, so Don Quixote goes into the woods. Rocinante smells some mares, gets loose, and Don Quixote is beaten by a bunch of Yagasan cattle drivers. Basically, Rocinante has tried to mount their mares. They're trying to get Rocinante off. They beat up Rocinante. Don Quixote comes to Rocinante's rescue, and they beat up Don Quixote. Okay. So that's when they, Sancho, Don Quixote's beaten to the point that he can't really do much anymore, and Sancho takes him to an inn that Don Quixote, of course, mistakes for a castle.
Of course.
There's the innkeeper, the wife, the daughter, and Maritornes, who's the servant in the inn, and she's a one-eyed, physically disabled prostitute. Okay, so Maritornes makes arrangements with a mule driver. Don Quixote mistakes her for Dulcinea in the middle of the night. There's a fight in the dark because all of this prostitution assignation is taking place in the dark. In the dark, basically Maritornes thinks she's trying to find her mule driver that she's trying to have sex with. Yeah. Don Quixote trips her up by accident and says, oh, this must be Dulcinea, and sort of projects onto her this kind of, you know, romantic ideal and thinks Dulcinea is coming for him. Don Quixote gets in a fight with the mule driver and with Maritornes. And in the middle of this, the Holy Brotherhood shows up. Okay, the Holy Brotherhood was kind of like they were sort of like the feds, more or less.
Yeah.
But the feds as put together through the Catholic Church. So they're sort of like a federal agency, more or less, because they have, as Spain opened up more and more roads, the crown was concerned about crime on the roads between jurisdictions. So the Holy Brotherhood was this kind of like Catholic office that would police that.
Yeah, it was kind of a it was like a Catholic Church's in-house anti-highwayman police force. Yeah.
So they were the ones you didn't want to mess with. And yeah. So a member of the Holy Brotherhood shows up and everyone shuts up because they don't want to get, you know, taken to the gallows, except for Don Quixote, and the member of the Holy Brotherhood beats up Don Quixote, smashes a lantern over his head. And that's when Don Quixote decides it's time to make the balm that he's been convinced he can make. So he gets whatever ingredients together that he can, boils them in a pot, drinks them. Sancho drinks the dregs, and Don Quixote vomits all over himself, and Sancho shits himself. And Don Quixote vomits and goes to sleep, and Sancho stays up all night with diarrhea. Okay, so they leave without paying because Don Quixote considered that as a knight errant, he should be able to stay in whatever castle was open to him. And Sancho is caught by a bunch of mule drivers and tossed in a blanket. Okay, so Don Quixote charges at a bunch of sheep that he thinks is an army and then gets mauled by the sheep and the shepherds. There's a funeral at night. It looks like a bunch of ghosts carrying torches. It turns out it's a bunch of priests carrying torches and a funeral procession that's going to the next town. Don Quixote attacks that and then gets beat up. He has a bunch of rocks thrown at him through slingshots. They knock out a bunch of his teeth, and that's how he becomes the Knight of the Sorrowful Face.
Yes. I always liked that bit, that was... Yes. He gets this, and he's sort of pleased with that, you know, that epithet.
Yeah.
It does sound very chivalric, but then, you know, Sancho explains like, oh, no, it's just with all your teeth out, your face droops.
Yeah. So... Sancho gives him that name, and he's content enough with it. They go to the woods and hear a terrible noise. Don Quixote wants to attack whatever it is, and Sancho is scared, and in the dark, he hobbles Rocinante so Rocinante won't move, and that's where he shits himself again. Okay. there's the tale of the goats in the boat. Sancho tries to tell this bizarre tale of this man who has to transport goats in a boat from one side of the river to another, and Don Quixote is supposed to remember how many goats have gone across, and Don Quixote can't remember, and Sancho loses count, so the story is over. So it's another tale in the, I mean, we'll come back to it, but it's another narrative in this story about narratives. It's another version of a narrative, and it's a narrative that goes nowhere.
Right. Okay. And honestly, I feel like when I feel like when I first read that, I thought to myself, like, I guess I first interpreted it as like, okay, is this Sancho trying to cleverly get Don Quixote to just go to sleep instead of checking out these noises by getting him to count goats or something? Yeah. But I kind of realized, I don't think Sancho is that clever. I don't think he would attempt such a ruse. Yeah.
No. At least not in the first book. In the second book, he shows some brains, but in the first book, not so much. So in the morning, they finally see the light, literally, and they realize that the noise that had been scaring them was a mill. It was more their fulling hammers, but it's basically like this mill powered by the water to pound down wheat or grain. Sancho laughs. Don Quixote gets upset, and tells Sancho, let's never tell anyone of this ever again. Don Quixote beats up a barber, steals the basin that the barber was wearing on his head, claims it's the helmet of Mambrino. And if you can't tell it's the helmet of Mambrino, then it's just because the helmet has been enchanted and we just need to disenchant it. And as soon as we do that, then everybody will see this is the most fantastic helmet you've ever seen in your world. They quote unquote rescue a bunch of men headed for the galley. they find a bunch of prisoners who claim that they're being unjustly taken to the galleys to be put to work as slaves for the king. They leave out the fact that they're prisoners, and Don Quixote immediately takes their side. That's where we meet Ginés de Pasamonte, who will show up again several times in the second book. Ginés de Pasamonte is an actual picaro who is writing his memoirs, sort of like the innkeeper, that first innkeeper. He's writing his memoirs, but he hasn't finished them, and Don Quixote wonders why he hasn't finished them, and he's not dead yet. So he has to keep writing them. Keep that in mind, because we'll come back to that later. So they beat up a bunch of the Holy Order kind of by accident, and the prisoners get away. The prisoners see Don Quixote, and Don Quixote tells them to go back to La Mancha to tell Dulcinea of all the wonderful things that he's done, and they get tired of Don Quixote and beat him up a little bit.
Okay. I really have to say, I really do enjoy just how regularly Don Quixote just sort of gets, you know, gets a few haymakers, gets kicked, just kind of. He gets abused quite a bit, and he dishes it out too. Though I mean, he's, you know.
Yeah, it's weird. We can talk about that in a second, because there's something about the tone of that's really kind of weird. Okay, so Sancho drags Don Quixote to the Sierra Morena Mountains. Sancho is convinced they're going to be nabbed by the Holy Brotherhood. Now they've really done something that could get them in some trouble, and so Sancho wants to lay low for a while. And Don Quixote, they find a satchel. This is where the narrative sort of kicks into high gear. They find a satchel with a note, and they find a goat herd who tells them of a ragged man who's lucid at some intervals, and then at other times is insanely violent. Okay, they meet this ragged man, and they hear half of his story. Okay, so this is one of the narratives within the narrative, and we were talking about this last time. The difference between this and other kinds of Renaissance tales is that this takes place – this is a kind of typical Renaissance tale, but it takes place within the narrative frame. There's no clear distinction between the narrative frame and the tale, because Don Quixote interacts with the teller and ultimately interacts with the tale. Mm-hmm. So that blurring of the lines, that blurring of the frame, is sort of what makes this closer to a novel and not so much like a collection of Renaissance tales like Boccaccio's Decameron. So the ragged man is named Cardenio. Cardenio loves Lucinda, and he becomes part of the court for the Duke. Ricardo befriends part of the court for the Duke. He's supposed to be there to sort of serve or be a cleric for Ricardo, the older son, and he befriends the younger son, Fernando. Okay, Fernando is in love with a local peasant girl and then suddenly wants to go to Cardenio's homeland. Fernando starts getting interested in Lucinda, and that's when Don Quixote interrupts with some kind of pedantic note about the chivalric order. He gets in a fight with Cardenio. Cardenio beats him up and runs off. Okay.
Yeah.
So Don Quixote decides that what he has to do in order to show Dulcinea, who doesn't exist, how crazy in love he is to play the part of the crazy lover. So he's going to stay in the Sierra Morena and basically lose his mind. And he needs Sancho to witness some of this so that Sancho can take a note to Dulcinea and say, look, Don Quixote's love for you is so intense that he has lost his mind. And he's basically modeling himself after the old chivalric romances and to a degree modeling himself after Cardenio, who apparently has had some kind of romantic thwarting to the point that he is no longer sane.
Yeah.
Okay. So Sancho says he'll take whatever note Don Quixote wants back to Dulcinea. And he also has a letter for a bunch of mules that Don Quixote tells his niece to give to Sancho. So that's the kind of goad to get Sancho going. And on the way back, Sancho meets the priest and the barber at the inn where he and Don Quixote had previously stayed a couple nights before. At the inn, the priest and the barber are looking for Don Quixote because they realize that he got loose and they're trying to track him down. And they come up with this plan. The priest will disguise himself as an afflicted maiden, and the barber will dress up with a fake beard and pretend to be her servant, and they'll tell Don Quixote that she's in trouble and he needs to help kill a giant. Okay.
Yeah.
So they enter the Sierra Moreno, and they meet Cardenio. They hear the rest of Cardenio's story. Essentially, Fernando got him out of the way, convinced Lucinda's parents that marrying Fernando would be in their best interest. Cardenio snuck back, and Lucinda planned to kill herself. Cardenio was going to kill Fernando, but he sees Lucinda actually say yes at the marriage. She faints, and Cardenio leaves in a fit of anger. He runs to the Sierra Morena, and that's how he's lost his mind.
Yeah.
Okay. So, the priest, the barber, Cardenio, and Sancho head further into the Sierra Morena, and that's where they find a beautiful woman disguised as a shepherdess. Okay. This is Dorotea, who had been seduced by Fernando way back when Cardenio was hanging in the town at the court. Dorotea was the peasant girl that Fernando was into. She's a rich man's daughter with a very good head for business, and she was very, very skeptical of Fernando. But he played on her sympathy, and so did her lady-in-waiting, and they both convinced her that Fernando would be a good match. And they had this kind of, okay, saying or pledging by God that you would marry someone in 17th century Spain counted for the wedding, at least often in the eyes of the participants.
Oh, yeah.
So Fernando proclaimed his love and proclaimed his desire in front of God with Dorotea as the only witness, had his way with her, and then split.
Yeah.
So she disguised herself as a boy and fled into the woods. One man tried to rape her. She killed him. She threw him over a cliff. Another tried, and she fled from him. And so now she's in hiding in the Sierra Morena. So the priest convinces her to come along. The priest and the barber basically say, hey, we can look after you. Here's Cardenio. They introduce him. They disguise Dorotea as the princess of Micomicon, and use her to meet Don Quixote to request help to defeat a giant. And the idea is that her kingdom is just over the hill of La Mancha, so we'll have to pass through La Mancha anyway. So let's go back this way. All right. So they start heading back. And that's when they meet Andres, the boy whom Don Quixote freed. And like we said, he was headed to Seville, which signals maybe there was something shady about this dude in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
They go to the inn. That's where the innkeeper has a novella that they read called The Man Who Is Recklessly Curious, written by Miguel de Cervantes.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, this is the I think this is the second time that Cervantes' material has appeared in the work, because he was wasn't when the priest and the barber were going through Don Quixote's library at his home, there were a couple of items that were Miguel de Cervantes, to which the priest is moved to say, "Ah, yes, this stuff is great. This guy's great."
Yeah. Yeah. So they come across this stuff again, and we have this narrative within the narrative. I mean, this is kind of the case that I've been making, is that all of these narratives get intertwined, and it's difficult to pick them apart. So The Man Who's Recklessly Curious is about two dudes, Anselmo and Lotario. Anselmo has married a beautiful woman, and he doubts her faithfulness, so he keeps trying to set Lotario up with her. Echevarria, the scholar we were talking about last time, points mm-hmm. out that there's like this homoerotic subtext between them, that they can engage with each other if they have the woman between them in this kind of romantic triangle. At first, Lotario says he pretends to come on to the woman, but then, you know, won't actually do it. And his friend finds out that he's been faking it and forces him to come on to his wife. And they begin an affair that all ends in tragedy. And that goes on for nearly 100 pages. So we have this novella within the novel. And so it's mm-hmm. sort of like, you know, one more tale. But it's a tale that reflects on all of these romantic tales that have been told so far. And yeah. I'll talk a little bit later. I've got some ideas about the sort of narrative function later. Okay, so Don Quixote is in bed at this point. Then he wakes up and attacks a bunch of wineskins. Fernando shows up with Lucinda, and the whole gang works to get the couples right. Basically, the priest, the barber, Lucinda, Cardenio, Fernando, and Dorotea all come together to sort of get the romantic math straight. Yeah. And Cardenio ends up with Lucinda. Fernando goes back to Dorotea. And all seems well. So, that's when we have the story of the captive. This Muslim woman walks in, or a woman dressed in Muslim or Arab garb, and she walks in with this man who looks really, really sunburnt, and that's the story of the captive and Zoraida. So, this is mm-hmm. basically an autobiographical tale that Cervantes worked in here. The captive is this guy who had gone, he was one of three brothers whose father split their inheritance in three and said, go whichever way you want. One becomes a priest, one becomes a judge. The third, the captive, goes to joins the army and becomes a soldier. He fights in the Navy and then is captured by pirates, sold into slavery in, I believe it's Morocco, mm-hmm. and then is helped out by this woman whose father is extraordinarily wealthy, who had a Christian servant who turned her to Christianity, and now she wants to get out of Muslim lands to get to, a Christian nation. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole adventure story about them breaking out and finally getting to Spain and finally ending up in this inn, and they're trying to get back to the soldier's, place of birth or his origin. So in the middle of that, a judge shows up who's on his way to the New World with his daughter. And the judge turns out to be the captive's brother. There's a reunion scene. And then there's this boy mule driver who's following the judge's daughter, who turns out to be a member of the nobility, who is a neighbor of theirs, who's in love with her, and his father's got a bunch of men looking for him, and then this whole fight at the inn occurs. The sort of our gang on one side, the other men on the other side, Don Quixote caught in the middle. The Holy Brotherhood arrives. The whole thing is broken up, and everyone is sort of convinced to leave Don Quixote alone, because at this point, Don Quixote really is in trouble for having freed the galley slaves.
Yeah.
But everyone, including the judge, sort of works on the Holy Brotherhood to say, just let this guy go. He's crazy. Don't worry about him. Let him go.
There's nothing to gain by trying to. Yeah, it's really just like, well, I think that's what, you know, so many people, the conclusion they come to is like, just let this guy be nuts. Like, there's nothing we can do about this. Trying to stop it isn't going to help anything, you know, or at least, you know, trying to stop it directly by manhandling him isn't going to help anything.
Yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So, all right. The barber arrives that, you know, the one who was in possession of Mambrino's helmet. He says, I want my helmet back. Well, or I want my basin back. And by this point, it's been more or less demolished. The priest and the barber pay him off, so all's good. They figure that now's their chance. While Don Quixote falls asleep, they build this kind of cage for him in a wagon. And they convince him that he's been enchanted by some wizard. And he can't get out of the cage. And he says, well, if it's a wizard's enchantment, even though these bars look like, I mean, this is just wood. I could knock this over. But yeah, it checks out. So enchantment, I guess I got to stay here.
them's the rules, huh? You know?
So basically, the judge's daughter is now in love with the boy. And that romantic math works out. A bunch of the lovers have to pass back through La Mancha in order to get to where they're going. So the whole thing is like this caravan back to La Mancha with Don Quixote in the back, so-called enchanted by wizards, even though he can easily open the bars and get out and pee when he needs to.
Yeah.
Okay. So on the way back, they meet a canon who gives a long speech on art. He gives this long discourse on art and aesthetics, and they have this picnic, and that's when they meet a goat herd who tells the story of the most beautiful girl in his town who was seduced and abandoned by a fake soldier, and he was in love with her, everyone else was in love with her, and he's punishing all of femininity by talking to his female goat and shaming it for all of its licentious ways.
Yeah.
Don Quixote gets into a fight with him, and the canon laughs at the stupidity of both and says, hey, just look at these two idiots. Let them fight it out. They'll get tired after a while. Ha 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 ha. Then they go back to La Mancha at the end. And that's, that's sort of what I find so fascinating is it ends just as abruptly as it began. It's just they go back. Don Quixote says, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. The end. And of course he does do it again because there's a sequel, but it's just this kind of begin and end. It's up, it's down, done.
Right. You know. Which is especially interesting considering how much care was given to tying up all the loose ends of all these ancillary characters we meet along the way.
I mean, almost to an absurd degree.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
Everything has to come back. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really pretty silly. And then it just stops. Okay. So, I mean, we get some dedicatory verses at the end, and this claim that the narrator or author or whatever this being is has seen the grave of Don Quixote or seen poems on the grave of Don Quixote, and that's it. Okay, so it's so much fun. It's so weird. It took an hour to get that out. But it's, right. I mean, it's sort of like in recounting it, or nearly an hour, I don't know how long, but in recounting it, it just reminds me of the real fun of reading the text.
Yeah, yeah. And like we mentioned, I guess like we could say, I guess this will be part of the personal response portion of our podcast project. It's helped along by the fact that it is episodic. It's a very and we talked about in kind of the literary forebears episode that we did prior to this one about the how the picaresques would be like that, and some of the other sort of literary forms it's drawing on have that episodic quality. But that really does sort of help it go at a clip, to the extent that because there's part one and two, like it's basically two, it's all published as parts one and two together anymore. So it looks like this doorstopper,
right?
When you pick it up off the shelf. But it reads so fluently. And it's just, it's one thing after another. It's madcap. And even with these sort of odd digressions into, it becomes an anthology of tales almost. Yeah. It's similar to the Decameron, or really like I almost thought like sort of an ass backwards Canterbury Tales, but in a real way, because we have like this setup where a bunch of people end up telling each other tales, and then get together and form a caravan that goes to their destination,
right, and then stop.
Right. It's a delight to read. Yeah,
I hadn't really thought about that connection to the Canterbury Tales, but I think you're right that caravan aspect to it really drives it towards the end. All right, so there's a bunch of analytical stuff. I thought way too much about this because I have a very long train ride, but there are a couple of things that are really worth digging into and thinking about. And part of this is inspired by some of the scholarship that we were talking about last time. And part of it is also just other weird observations. But the first thing that's really fun about this is how much of it draws from the idea of self-invention. That's really at the heart of this. Don Quixote invents an identity for himself. You know, mm-hmm.
He invents an identity for himself, and he invents identities for everyone around him while he's at it. Yeah,
and whoever he doesn't misread, he draws into his adventures and makes them a part of this fantasy that he has. Well, okay, we'll get into it in part two. It may not be a fantasy, but he draws everyone else into what he's doing. So he reinvents himself in the image of his idea of the best possible him that he could be. And he uses literature to do it. But this is a running theme throughout the whole novel. He's not the only one drawing an identity from literature. He's not the only one modeling himself after past stories. Nearly everybody else is. Okay, so you have Marcella and Grisostomo, who are modeling themselves after Arcadian shepherds. Marcella to one degree, Grisostomo to another degree. But they're both sort of leaving behind their past lives to become their so-called ideal. Yeah. And Echevarria has this read on this where he says, you know, this would have been fishy in the 17th century because the expectation would be that Marcella and Grisostomo, well, they're both rich kids. They're both from, you know, minor aristocratic families. What this should be is joining houses. Like, should be a coupling where they're continuing the line and continuing the order. But it's not. It's like the erotics of it actually get in the way. And I'll talk about that in a little bit, but they're another example of someone, okay, we're going to give up. This is straight from the pastoral. We're going to give up this cruddy old city life mm-hmm. and go live in the country where it's easy. And that leads to tragedy. Okay, so that's one set of characters that really sort of draw from literature. But everyone else is very familiar with chivalric tales.
Yeah, yeah.
The niece and the housekeeper can really just jump in and pick up on the need to continue the tale and can improvise, showing that they know how these things run. The priest and the barber also show that ability to improvise. They develop their own chivalric tale in order to try to trap Don Quixote within it. They know these stories and they begin to model their own behavior, you know, mockingly, I guess, or I guess yeah. Cervantes is mocking their attempts to do so. It's not in the same register as Don Quixote, but they also are modeling their behavior after chivalric tales. It even gets to something like, okay, you've got the Picaros that I keep pointing out. They're self-consciously Picaros. The innkeeper is a Picaro and he knows the genre that he's writing in and supposed to be living in. Ginés de Pasamonte also knows the genre that he's writing in and supposed to be living in. So they're conforming to certain kinds of literary rules. Don Fernando is adopting the attitude of the Don Juan. The Don Juan character. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the role he's playing out. And it's extraordinarily easy to get him to drop it. So is that just some kind of identity he had for himself? Or is that, you know, like, is that a role that he's playing? That seems to be sort of the lingering question there. And Cardenio and Lucinda, there's this really interesting moment. They seem to be a perfect match, even according to their parents.
Yeah.
This is when Cardenio is telling his story. He says, "Our parents, with all the simplicity, our parents knew of our intentions and were not troubled by them because they saw clearly that in time these intentions could have no other end but our marriage, something that was practically guaranteed by the equality of our families and our fortunes. We matured, as did our love, until it seemed to Lucinda's father that, in deference to public opinion, he was obliged to deny me entrance to his house, almost imitating in this regard the parents of that same Thisbe, praised so often by poets." The parents have to model their behavior after Pyramus and Thisbe, or after the myth of Pyramus and Thisbe,
yeah.
because they have to put up a show of, well, we can't let this guy have it too easy, but they're ready, willing, and able to just let the kids be together. And if they had just let the kids be together, wouldn't things have been a lot better? Okay, so anyway, everybody is modeling themselves off of some kind of literary forebear. I mean, it just, like, as soon as you start looking for it, you can't not see it.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is infused with this kind of literary awareness. Okay, so, excuse me. So I want to come back to Marcella and Grisostomo. Because there are two moments in the book that I think, or at least in the first book, that are really kind of dark. The first is Marcel and Grisostomo. And yeah. That one is really kind of grim. It ends in a really sad way. Marcella, I would argue that she's allowed to keep her dignity. But there's something else that I think is lurking back there. And this is another thing that Echevarria writes about, and he actually did a whole book about. And that is the book that I was talking about last time. I sort of ended our discussion with this pseudo-novel or tragicomedy, or I'm not quite sure what it is, Celestina. La Celestina was this weird work. It's almost like a novel with no narration, or it's a play that could not be performed. It was written by this guy named Fernando de Rojas. Rojas was from a family of conversos, and in fact, his Jewish conversos. And his uncle, I believe, was caught by the Inquisition for some offhand comment he'd made 2 years earlier in a tavern, and then tortured because he wouldn't confess because he couldn't even remember what he was supposed to confess to.
Yeah.
I'm bringing this up to sort of have us keep in mind that, you know, I think in our side conversations that we were having before, you know, over the past month, we were talking about the Reconquista and the Inquisition as mm-hmm. this moment of essentially ethnic cleansing.
Yeah. And what's very interesting about it is that it didn't begin as ethnic cleansing, but rather it's a cleansing that took on an ethnic component.
Yeah.
Because you have to remember that this all goes back to the kind of extreme Catholic nationalism of the the conquering kingdoms led chiefly by Castile, which could be argued that was actually an imported ideology that was imported by the crusading movement, which began in northern France. But I think we've actually talked a little bit about that. But it's not just a native Spanish thing. It's almost like a pan-Catholic project that became most concentrated and virulent in Spain. But what kind of came of it is that, so political power in the peninsula by this point, completely expunged any Muslim political power. Basically, they're converting people by the sword all over the place. You can either convert to Christianity, or you can leave, or you can get killed. And so there's these mass expulsions, which at this point are, to the extent that you can draw a distinction between, an ethnos and a religion at this point, which is itself kind of dodgy. There's religiously motivated, the Spanish authorities, or I should say the Catholic Spanish authorities, are like, look, as long as you convert, whatever. But the problem becomes, you have these people in your state, in your body politic, that are you don't quite trust that they're all the way there. There's still some kind of otherness to them. There's an otherhood that rankles. And so the Spanish Inquisition enters this phase where they're not just, they're basically on the lookout, not just for like heresy, but heresy of the blood. They're going after, they're trying to dig up. And cause once you adopt for most people, when you adopt a new religion, you tend to adopt a new name in keeping with that religious tradition. So you had all these Jewish families, formerly Jewish families, formerly Muslim families. So the conversos and the Moriscos. And so now, instead of just, they thought they were safe, they thought they were assimilated, because of this fear of crypto-Judaism, this fear of crypto-Islam, this fear that the inborn corruption in the blood of these people would destroy the great Catholic nation, it becomes an ethnic cleansing. It becomes where they're not just expelling anyone who refuses to assimilate, they're expelling anyone who wasn't, quote-unquote, really Spanish, which is of course preposterous, but it's an extremely ugly process, and extremely and of course, because you have these people who can, I don't know if using words like pass is the right way to do it, but a lot of these families could pass as good Catholic Christian Spaniards because they were, and because everyone looks the same, it's not like you're going to be able to actually look at somebody, but if you have enough, you know, if there's enough knowledge of the family history in the village, your neighbor can inform on you.
Right.
You know, your local headman can inform on you. And it's just a very, very ugly time.
And, I mean, that's I don't want to get too far down this because it seems too pat, but I am very curious about whether this obsession with self-invention and self-reinvention has something to do, like in the novel, has to do with this idea of conversion.
I think it's deeply involved because it became, just think about it. Reinvention or coming up with a new story about yourself and your family became a matter of survival.
Yeah.
You had to reinvent, you had to create or piece together or somehow make a convincing argument that you have this family story, this family narrative that does not include these people, you know, in the woodpile.
Right.
these people who had been there for literally centuries and who were every bit as part of the landscape and the people there as anyone else. But you had to reinvent. You had to, not only did you have to reinvent, but you had to reinvent according to, you had to reinvent according to an ideal.
Right.
And I think that comes through very strongly, of course. I mean, that's the whole story of Don Quixote, isn't it? He's reinventing himself and envisioning himself in the light of this Catholic Spanish ideal. And you had many hundreds of thousands of people attempting to do that. Just so they didn't get, you know, put to the torch.
Well, that's the weird part of Celestina. So Rojas wrote this book called La Celestina, and it's about this young nobleman who's in love with this girl who's his neighbor. He doesn't want to get the girl. He wants to play the part of the amorous lover. And he's got the servant. The servant points out to him, like on the second page, well, just go tell your dad to tell her dad to hook you guys up. You're rich. You're an aristocrat. She's rich. She's an aristocrat. It'd be a perfect match. What's the problem? Well, the problem is that that's not what the courtly lover does. So he has to go through this whole rigmarole of working with this local bawd named Celestina in order to get the girl. And she's this character who's maybe kind of a witch. She specializes in love potions and sewing up hymens to simulate virginity. And she works behind the scenes with all of her nefarious tricks in order to try to get the two kids together. And this starts out comedic and ends tragic because the kid falls off a wall, breaks his neck, and dies. The girl sees it, kills herself. The servants figure out what Celestina was up to and kill her. And so it all sort of goes south. It's a self-reinvention and a play acting that ends in tragedy. And the reason I wanted to bring it up is because there's so much of, like, just the outlines of that story itself that sounds like Marcellin Grisostomo.
Absolutely.
The reinvention ends in tragedy, but Don Quixote really has to work to throw that off. There's something about that one episode that really still strikes me throughout the whole book, that it's allowed. A woman is allowed dignity, and that goes in the face of a lot of the misogyny of the culture at the time. And it's a really profound moment in the text. It really stands out. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think what also kind of stands out about it is that not only does Marcella have a voice to kind of she uses her voice to push back against the idea that this is tragedy in the sort of technical sense.
Yes.
Or at least it's just like, look, yeah, this guy was an idiot and this is bad, but it's not like cosmically horrible. It's not this kind of I guess the hubris at work, if we can use the Aristotelian definition of tragic, which I'm sure we all shall, this kind of hubris at work, I guess, and, you know, she's pushing back on this idea that, like, I don't know. It feels like she's pushing back on the idea that we should be especially upset that he died because he was so in love with her.
Right. And she's like, this has nothing to do with me.
I mean, right. Right.
This is above and beyond. I mean, this is rape culture. This mm-hmm. is a culture where it struck me reading this one, this time through, how often rape comes up.
Yeah.
Because it's always lurking in the sidelines for every female character.
Yeah,
it really, really is.
And just to sort of speak to like the sort of the culture, the rape culture aspect of it, I you know, it's very interesting to me, or I think it's very telling that, you know, every woman is basically assumed to be responsible for the actions of the men around her.
Yeah.
And not only the actual actions of the men around her, she's held responsible for the inner state of this man.
That's exactly right.
What, you know, and what the hell are you supposed to do about that? You know, like, yeah, my God.
Yeah. And that I think is why the Marcella episode really sticks out, because it is directly speaking back against all of that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And there's something else that I think it's doing. And this is where, you know, I've got this kind of idea about Don Quixote. There's this kind of Freudian thing going on here, and this is where we can talk about sex and desire in Don Quixote. There's this way in which Don Quixote has set himself up to never not be questing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what he did was elevated this peasant woman to the status of his lady love. But according to the chivalric courtly ideal, you're not supposed to get the girl. The girl is supposed to be so far beyond you. And the point of the quest is to prove your love and prove your heroism to the woman. And she will never accept that heroism. It's never enough.
Right.
So you keep doing more and you keep doing more and you keep doing more.
It sets up this kind of, what's the math term? Asymptotic relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of masochism. I was thinking about this because I'm teaching a summer class and we were doing Midsummer Night's Dream. And there's mm-hmm. a character in Midsummer Night's Dream. It's Helena, if you ever read it. And she's in love with this guy who doesn't love her, or who used to love her and fell out of love and now is in love with this other girl. And so Helena, I mean, tells him literally, treat me like your dog. I just want to be around you. Abuse me, hurt me. And Helena goes to the point of telling this guy that she's in love with that the girl he's in love with has fled into the woods with her lover to try to go one town over to elope. And so it's this whole sort of, I mean, it's, if we're doing our Simpsons references, it's Milhouse thinking to himself, you know, when Lisa sees that I'll give a note to her, the guy she has a crush on, then she's bound to fall in love with me, because then she'll realize I'll do anything, right?
Yeah.
It's this kind of masochistic desire that is going on in there. And there's something, I think, kind of masochistic about Don Quixote, except he's doing something a little bit different. Now, he more or less invented his chivalric ideal. He mm-hmm. more or less invented Dulcinea. So his erotic fantasy is a woman who will never completely have him, so that he'll have to keep questing in order to please her, and she'll never be pleased.
Yeah.
Don Quixote has invented for himself a way never to stop playing.
Yeah. Right. It's setting up this kind of endless, it's the endless treadmill, right? It's the, it's like those smartphone games, endless runner smartphone games, where you just keep going and going and going, you know, and the whole point is just go as long as you can, you know. It's, but right. He set it up for himself, not only from the standpoint of, I mean, that's kind of baked in anyway to the idea of the, you know, courtly love and dedicating yourself to this woman you can never have, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, he takes it even a step further and dedicating himself to an imaginary woman he can never have.
So he's fulfilled by not being fulfilled.
Right.
So it's this weird way where he's kind of self-satisfied.
Well, he's it's a kind of masturbatory Sisyphean ordeal he set up for himself.
Exactly. But that's what allows him to develop a singular identity. And I want to bring this back to Marcella. She also has done the same thing. She is sort of self-fulfilled in adopting the identity of a shepherdess being a shepherdess. Mm-hmm. It's antisocial in the same way that Don Quixote's ideal is sort of antisocial, i.e., it's completely his own fantasy, and no amount of dragging him back to town is ever really going to break him from it, mm-hmm. because it's a fantasy so, I guess, self-fulfilling in its non-fulfillment that it can't ever be fulfilled. It can't ever stop. There's something I think kind of similar in Marcella. She's a sort of parallel to Don Quixote in this way. Mm-hmm. That I think is what gives her power. And I think she really does have power in this text, but that's sort of like the weird kind of fulfillment and non-fulfillment that I think drives Don Quixote.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right to draw that, that kind of parallel, that kind of, there's self-conscious. It's not even quite image making is not quite fair to say, but it is self construction with an image as this kind of lodestar, I guess, this kind of guiding light. Yeah.
So the third thing that really sort of struck me this time around has to do with cruelty and violence. And I was talking about this a little bit when we were talking about the canon. Mm-hmm. Cruelty is really going to play a part in the second book of Don Quixote. One of the main, I guess, episodes in the second book is when Don Quixote goes to the house of these aristocrats who've read the first book of Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, we know this guy. Let's mess with him.
And right. Oh, yeah, we know. Yeah, we know this. Oh, this is that crazy guy we read about, honey.
Yeah. And so they spend several chapters just humiliating him. And it really piles on the cruelty. And in the middle of all this humiliation, Don Quixote begins to get more and more, more and more generous. He gets more and more verbose. He becomes more and more eloquent. Mm-hmm. And we're really made to feel for him. What it does is puts an audience there, or it makes us aware of ourselves as an audience. Mm-hmm. In much of book one, we're laughing at him because we're not watching others laugh at him. But when we see others laugh at him, we're made aware of the cruelty in the violence.
Yeah, yeah.
Except when the canon comes in. It's when the canon comes in. I'm sorry, not except. It's when the canon comes in that there's a shift in how we have to understand the violence, because the canon is an authority figure, and the canon basically says, hey, look at these idiots. And suddenly we're watching someone watch Don Quixote.
Right. Yeah.
He's a kind of audience stand-in, and there's something extraordinarily mean and mean-spirited about that.
Yeah.
It strikes me that Cervantes tends to do this when an authority shows up. That's kind of my thesis here, because it's the aristocrats in the second book, and it's the canon in this book. The canon is the only real authority, aside from the Holy Brotherhood, who are just more
right. They're the vague jackboot of the whole shebang, you know, rather than any kind of specific personage.
Yeah, the priest is just a local do-gooder who doesn't really have much power. The barber is the barber. The other aristocrats are sort of involved in their love story, or involved in their love tale, to the degree that they're just overly involved in their own affairs.
Yeah.
The canon is the one person that I find in the first book has real power. Mm-hmm. But what does he do with that power? He exercises it in this really cruel way. Earlier, when there had been a fight, you know, the judge, the priest, the barber, Fernando, Cardenio, everybody worked to sort of cool it. Like, okay, it got to a point, but we'll cool it down. Don't worry about Don Quixote. He's fine. It's when the canon, this figure of church authority and moral highness, comes in. That's when we're made aware of the cruelty here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, like, I think it's, I thought it was very interesting that's kind of the first act of authority that we get in the whole text, is the first act of authority is the act of policing Don Quixote's imagination.
Yeah.
That's the sort of the first, you know, it's taken upon themselves, you know, the priest and the barber take it on themselves to go and again, I guess it feels sort of, you know, not the same, but it feels like in sort of a similar wheelhouse of how women are expected to be responsible for the interior life of the men around them. This, you know, this fellow took it upon himself to be responsible directly for the interior life of Don Quixote to the extent that he ransacked his house.
Yeah.
To put police, it was literally thought policing, which, you know, if you're going to have, hey, if you're going to have thought police, you know, 17th century Spain is where they're going to be. But,
yeah, it's, I don't know. It just really, really struck me, that cruelty really comes out. Mm-hmm. And we end, I mean, like I said, the book just kind of stops.
Yeah.
And we just end in this kind of equivocal place. Earlier, Don Quixote had this long conversation with the canon. I don't know how to interpret the canon's art critique. Mm-hmm. The canon gets basically a chapter and a half or two chapters of literary theory of what makes a good play and what doesn't make a good play, of what makes good writing, what doesn't make good writing. Echevarria was saying that, I mean, I think in a throwaway line, he claimed that this is essentially Cervantes' point of view, so that the canon represents Cervantes, at least to the degree that he echoes Cervantes' ideas about art. I'm not sure. I don't have enough context to make a judgment there.
Yeah.
But it does seem very, very strange that if the canon represents Cervantes' views, that the canon is this kind of author of cruelty in a way. And then something happens. Don Quixote interrupts the canon and they get into this kind of conversation about the veracity of chivalric tales. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess we were talking about this a little bit last time, but basically what Don Quixote wants to know is, well, who's to say what's true and what's not? If it's written in a book and it was allowed to be published, well, shouldn't it be true? So,
right.
You know, and he's saying, but there were these actual figures, and the canon wants to say, well, some of these were real, some of these weren't, some of these things could actually happen, some of these things couldn't. And Don Quixote basically says, well, I'm going by the book. It's all written down.
Yeah.
It's the best I have to do. So, no, it's real. And I mean, that really, you know, with this book that's so concerned about bookishness, that's so concerned about faith in this weird way, faith in what we read. I mean, I can't help but wonder if there's some covert stab there about believing in miracles, believing in the miraculous, believing in the supernatural to some degree that, you know, allows one to have faith. But I, again, I'm not entirely certain of the context, and I don't want to dive in there.
Right. And if, you know, we don't necessarily want to read back too much. Like, it's, I'm with you though. That's tantalizing. It's man, it's one of those, it's one of those things that has just enough supporting evidence to really seriously entertain the idea, yet you can't quite seal the deal that, well, I mean, that makes for good good journal writing, right? That's a good journal article.
Well,
that's called starting an academic conversation.
Yeah, I guess. If only I learned Spanish. But no, I mean, that's what it comes down to, is that it's a ripping, at least for me, it's a ripping read, but it cracks open all of these questions about epistemology, about the basis of truth, about the mm-hmm. nature of yourself. And when I was reading it in this time, I think we spent so much time with Montaigne, I can't get Montaigne out of my head. And it seems like the thing that everything we've done has in common is this question of the basis of truth. Mm-hmm. And what do you do when either truth is indeterminate or when you're epistemologically thrown?
Yeah.
You improvise. I mean, that was like the running thing in Montaigne, and that's absolutely what Don Quixote does.
Yeah, yeah. It's a kind of I mean, what is Don Quixote going through but like an extended, extreme epistemological crisis? to the extent that he sees giants where there are windmills and whatnot. But this, as you've, I think, ably pointed out, that kind of self-construction in the face of the, in the face of everything around them, like, you know, everybody's partaking of that to some extent in Don Quixote. It's just that Don Quixote himself is sort of the most extreme manifestation of it.
Yeah, and in some ways, he almost seems the most honest version.
Yeah.
We'll get to it when we get to book two. I've already started in on book two. I'm sorry.
No,
but
yeah, yeah.
In book two, at the very beginning, he says, I know who I am. I know what you're trying to do to me. I know what you're trying to say to me. Don't waste your time. I know exactly who I am. he's not pretending to be anything other than a knight errant, and everybody else claims to be their real self, but they're still drawing so much so from other sources. There's this way in which Don Quixote is upfront about constructing his identity off of the media that he's consumed, and everyone else, like, no one else will admit that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's, I think you're absolutely right. Like, there's the and I think I would venture that's why he elicits such a strong reaction from everybody. Is he's it's, can I even use the phrase, like, he's, you know, pulling the curtain back so we can see, because, you know, he's not. He's to use another cliche, pulling the wool over his own eyes, I guess, but right. In his sort of clownish attempt at it, I guess he's still again just clownishly doing well. I mean, and what is the clown? I guess that is the clowning is this kind of exaggerated performance of otherwise normal social cues and gestures and whatnot, and that's why everyone's creeped out by them and hates them. But that's what he's doing, just with this kind of aspect of self-guided performance.
Well, I'm reminded of two things. One, it's probably okay to talk about. The other is a little blue. The one is Jory Graham, the American poet, did a whole book called Swarm that is it's an apocalyptic book of poems. Mm-hmm. Really exploring what apocalypse means. It means ripping of the veil. And yeah. One of the things Graham keeps playing with is this idea that we know, like, the things we know because they are concealed. The veil allows us to give shape to what's underneath. And sometimes we can't know or understand what's underneath without the fictive covering, to draw a line from Wallace Stevens. And this reminds me of an anecdote that maybe I'll have Josh cut because it's a little bit blue. But I met this guy, I interviewed him in Boston. He was this weird dude. He was this older guy. I think he was like in his 60s, maybe a little bit older, but he was a painter and also made marionettes. Mm-hmm. He had this fantastic room full of, you know, bizarre marionettes, and he was fascinated by, I guess, 16th, 17th, 18th century methods of construction, not just marionettes, but also of paintings. And he developed his own, what are they called? The sort of shadow boxes that they would make, the reflective boxes that would project the image.
The camera obscura?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. He developed his own camera obscuras in order to paint in that way, to try to warp and do all this weird. I mean, it was really fascinating what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. But I got into this long conversation with him, and he was talking about the nature of reality in art. And he said, you know, I think about it like he said when he was a younger man, he ended up in Paris at a bunch of the burlesque houses and got to know the stripper. And he said, so how do you do it, man? How do you get out there and get naked? And she says, I don't get naked. She says, I be real, I conceal. Reality is not the ripping away of the cover. It's the fantasy we put over to know the truth.
That's
sort of what he was talking about, I hope.
Well, yeah, that's fascinating. And it reminds me of, did you ever see the, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he was an art scholar, and he did this, a series of art criticism documentaries for the BBC called Ways of Seeing.
Yeah, John Berger.
John Berger. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I know that. I know the book. I mean, it's a really great book.
It's a great book, and you should absolutely. It's on YouTube, and I recommend to every single listener out here. Please go to YouTube, look up John Berger, Ways of Seeing. The second episode of this is a 4-part series. It's 4 half-hour episodes, so you can watch it in an afternoon while you're doing dishes and whatever. Well, I hope it doesn't take 2 hours to do dishes, but you know what I mean.
That's a lot of plates.
It's a lot of dishes. Look, I got a lot of bottles to wash, man. But anyway, the second episode is fascinating because it's about the nude in the Western oil painting tradition. And I think it's an amazing bit of television because it's about an 8 or 9 minute sort of introductory comments by John Berger. And then he gives the entire rest of the show, the entire rest of the 20 minutes of the show over to a panel of 4 or 5 women to talk about the nude and talk about sort of the ways in which, because what Berger's thesis is and what sort of develops in the conversation among these women is this idea that there's a difference between being naked in between being nude.
Yeah.
And there's such an element of performance and there's an element of knowing you're being observed to the nude that it's just another set of clothes you put on.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of similar to what your acquaintance was talking about with the burlesque dancer in Paris. Go ahead.
Yeah. And to bring it back to Don Quixote knows reality by way of his fantasy.
Right.
And there's this way in which his reality is real because he gets to know it. Someone like Grisostomo dies tragically because not because he mistakes the fantasy for reality, but because he knows he's playing a part until he doesn't. You know, he deludes himself into thinking that he's in control. And Don Quixote, I don't think, does that. And then even Cardenio and Lucinda, they don't quite understand that they're taking on certain kinds of roles, you know? Don Quixote does. He actively does, and that allows him to know his reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, man, Don Quixote. This book is amazing. I'm really looking forward to reading the second part because I haven't read it yet.
That's right.
Because the first time I read Don Quixote, when we were first doing this, we did as we did similarly tonight, where we talked about the first part, then we were going to talk about the second part, and then, you know, things changed in the project. It came back in this format. But so I'm really I'm honestly really thrilled. I've read like excerpts and I've read like synopses.
Yeah.
But I'm really looking forward to actually reading it for myself because, you know, the way you've been talking about it, I'm ready to get really mad at these people being mean to my poor Don Quixote.
Well, it's weird. In the second book, and we'll talk about this, but this is just a heads up for anyone reading the second book. The characters shift a little bit because the whole conceit of the second book is that they know the first book was written Don Quixote is made aware that somebody wrote down his life. And so the whole point is to go have more adventures to finish the second book of Don Quixote. And the characters are aware of themselves as characters in this weird way. But Don Quixote and Sancho both become more eloquent, and it becomes less about the adventures and more about their conversations. And if possible, it becomes even more dialogic than the first book had been. Mm-hmm. So you get these long conversations between Sancho and Don Quixote where they basically share a delusion, but they talk each other into believing whatever it is they need to believe. And there's a lot of give and take. It's very sweet. It's very sweet in this way.
Yeah.
So did we finish?
I think so. Well, I mean, as much as you can finish with a densely self-referential ur text like Don Quixote, man. But no, I think this is a man. It's always great having a conversation with you, Claude, and I hope you listeners out there, as always, if you found any of this at all interesting, please go read the book. Read it for yourself. Have your own reactions. But of course, if you know. You can of course use what you learned today in our conversation we've had today to impress people at parties and act like you have read the book, because like Claude said, Don Quixote is one of those that's more talked about than read. I'm sorry, go ahead, man.
Oh yeah, but I was going to say please read it, because it really is a joy to get through. I mean, sometimes Montaigne felt a little bit like a slog,
yeah.
But this one, you just clip right through it. It's absolutely amazing. So I guess you can find us on Twitter.
I know I keep saying I'm going to actually set that up, this time maybe I will. but you can't find us on Facebook. We do have a cool Facebook group, so just search for The Cannonball, and we'll approve you for that. and
rate and review on iTunes, I suppose. And we also have the blog. I'm going to get some more writing up there soon.
Oh yeah,
It's The Cannonball Podcast at.
WordPress. That's right.
So thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. So find us there, and go read Don Quixote.
That's right. Go stop wasting your life and start reading about someone creating their own out of whole cloth. You're gonna love it.
Yeah. All right. Well, hope you enjoy, and I'll talk to you later, Daniel.
All right. Good night, man.